This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents Before She Disappeared by Lisa Gardner, performed by Hilary Huber. Chapter 1. The water feels like a cold caress against my face. I kick deeper down into the gloom, my long hair trailing behind me like a dark eel. I'm wearing clothes, jeans, tennis shoes, a t-shirt topped with an open windbreaker that wings out and slows my descent. My clothing grows heavier and heavier till I can barely flutter my legs, work my arms. Why am I in clothes? Wetsuit. Oxygen tank. Thoughts drift through my mind, but I can't quite grab them. I must reach the bottom of the lake, where the sunlight no longer penetrates and sinuous creatures lurk. I must find. I must do. My lungs are now as heavy as my legs. A feeling of pressure builds in my chest. An old Chevy truck. Dented, battered, with a cab roof sunbleached the color of a barely lit sky. This image appears in my mind and I seize it tightly. That's why I'm here. That's what I'm looking for, a sliver of silver in the lake's muck. I started with sonar, another random thought, but as I sink lower in the watery abyss, I can picture that too. Me, piloting a small boat that I'd rented with my own money, conducting long sweeps across the lake for 2 days straight, which was all I could afford, working a theory everyone else had dismissed. Until. Where's my wetsuit? My oxygen tank? Something's wrong. I must. I can't hold the thought. My lungs are burning. I feel them collapsing in my chest, and the desire to inhale is overwhelming. A single gasp of dark, cloudy water. No longer fighting the lake, but becoming one with it. Then I won't have to swim anymore. I will plummet to the bottom. And if my theory is right, I will join my target as yet another lost soul never to be seen again. Old truck. Cab roof sunbleached the color of a barely lit sky. Remember, focus, find it. Is that a glimpse of silver I see over there, partially hidden by a dense wall of waving grasses? I try to head in that direction, but get tangled in my flapping windbreaker. I pause, treading my legs frantically while trying to free my arms from my jacket's clinging grip. Chest constricting tighter. Didn't I have an oxygen tank? Wasn't I wearing a wetsuit? Something is so very wrong. I need to hold the thought, but the lake is winning, and my chest hurts and my limbs have grown tired. The water is soft against my cheek. It calls to me, and I feel myself answer. My legs slow. My arms drift up. I succumb to the weight of my clothes, the lead in my chest. I start to sink faster. Down, down, down. I close my eyes and let go. Paul always said I fought too much. I made things too hard, even his love for me. But, of course, I didn't listen. Now, a curious warmth fills my veins. The lake isn't dark and gloomy after all. It's a sanctuary, embracing me like a lover and promising to never let go. Then, not a spot of silver. Not the roof of an old battered truck that was already 100,000 miles beyond its best days. Instead, I spy a gouge of black appearing, then disappearing amid a field of murky green. I wait for the lake grasses to ripple left, then I see it again, a dark stripe, then another, and another, four identical shapes resting at the bottom of the lake. Tires. I'm looking at four tires. If I weren't so damn tired, I'd giggle hysterically. The sonar had told the truth. It had sent back a grainy image of an object of approximately the right size and shape resting at the bottom of the deep lake. It just hadn't occurred to me that said object might be upside down. Pushing through my lethargy now, urgency sparking one last surge of determination. They'd told me I was wrong. They'd scoffed, the locals coming out to watch with rolling eyes as I'd awkwardly unloaded a boat I had no idea how to captain. They called me crazy to my face, probably muttered worse behind my back. But now, move, find, swim before the lake wins the battle. Wetsuit. The words flutter through the back of my mind. Oxygen tank. This is wrong. Wrong. But in my befuddled state, I can't make it right. I push myself forward, fighting the water, fighting oxygen deprivation. They're right. I am crazy, and wild, and stubborn, and reckless. But I'm not broken. At least not yet. I reach the first tire, grab onto the slimy rubber to get my bearings. Quick now, not much time left. Rear tire. I crab my way along the algae-covered frame till I finally reach the front cab. Then I simply stare. Lainey Whitehorse, 22 years old, waitress, daughter, mother of a 3-year-old, a woman with an already long history of bad taste in men. She disappeared 18 months ago. Runaway, the locals decided. Never, her mother declared. And now she was found, trapped at the bottom of the lake that loomed next to the hairpin turn she drove each night after the end of her 2 a.m. bartending shift. Just as I had theorized while poring over months of interviews, maps, and extremely thin police reports. Had Lainey misjudged the corner she'd driven so many times before, startled at a crossing deer, or simply nodded off at the wheel, exhausted by a life that took too much out of her? I can't answer all the questions, but I can give her mother, her daughter, this. Lainey dangles upside down, her face lost inside the floating halo of her jet black hair, her body still belted into the cab she'd climbed into 18 months ago. My lungs are no longer burning. My clothes are no longer heavy. I feel only reverence as I curl my fingers around the door handle and pull. The door opens easily. Except, doors can't open underwater. Wetsuit. Oxygen tank. What is wrong? My brain belatedly sounds the alarm. Danger. Think. Except I can't. I am inhaling now, breathing in the lake, welcoming it inside my lungs. I have become one with it, or it has become one with me. As Lainey Whitehorse turns her head. She stares at me with her empty eye sockets, gaping mouth, skeletal face. Too late, she tells me. Too late. Then her bony arm thrusts out, snatches my wrist. I kick, try to pull back, but I've lost my grip on the door handle. I have no leverage. My air is gone, and I'm nothing but lake water and weedy grasses. She pulls me into the truck cab with unbelievable strength. One last scream. I watch it emerge as an air bubble that floats up, up, up. All that is left of me. Lainey Whitehorse slams the door shut, and I join her forever in the gloom. Rumble. Screech! A sudden booming announcement. South Station, next stop. I jerk awake as the train lurches to a halt, blinking and looking down at my perfectly dry clothes. A dream. Nightmare. Something. Not the first or the last in my line of work. It leaves me with a film of dread as I grab my bags and follow the rest of the passengers off the train. I'd found Lainey Whitehorse 3 weeks ago, locked in her vehicle at the bottom of a lake. After months of intensive research on an Indian reservation where my presence was never welcomed by the locals nor wanted by the tribal police. But I'd stumbled upon the case online and had been moved by her mother's steadfast assurance that Lainey would never leave her own daughter. Lainey might be a screw-up with horrible taste in men, but she was still a mom. Why people assumed those things couldn't go together, I'll never know. So I'd moved to the area, become a bartender at Lainey's former workplace, and started my own investigation. Lainey's mom hugged me the day the police finally dragged the Chevy truck out of the lake in a deluge of muck and horror, wailing, crying relief as Lainey was finally brought home. I waited around for the funeral, standing outside the small crowd of mourners, as proving yourself right almost always means proving someone else wrong and therefore rarely wins you many friends. I did what I needed to do. Then I headed to the local library, where I booted up the computer and returned to the national chat rooms where family members, concerned neighbors, and crazy people like me compare notes on various missing persons cases. There are so many, too many sometimes for local resources. So, more and more, people like me have been stepping into the vacuum. I read, I posted a few questions, and in a matter of hours, I knew where I was headed next. Like I said, so many missing persons cases. Too many. Which has brought me here, to Boston, a city I've never visited. I have no idea where I am or what I'm doing, but that's hardly new. Now, I follow the mass of humanity hustling along the train platform to the exit signs, all of my worldly possessions packed into a single piece of luggage rolling behind me. Once, I had a house, a car, a white picket fence, but time erodes, and now? Let's just say I've learned to travel light. Out on the bright sidewalk, I stop, blink, then shutter my eyes completely. Walking straight out into downtown Boston feels like an assault on the senses. People, shrieking horns, crosswalks, the stench of diesel fuel, fried fish, harbor brine. I've forgotten the crushing feel of the concrete jungle, even one with a glittering waterfront. I work on taking a deep, shuddering breath. This is my new home until I complete my mission. I exhale slowly. Then I open my eyes and square my shoulders. The last of my nightmare and travel days falls away. I'm ready to get to it, which is good given the flood of annoyed pedestrians shoving past me. From my worn leather messenger bag, I withdraw the file filled with papers I printed out days ago. It includes a map of Boston, articles on city demographics, and a photo of a shyly smiling girl with smooth dark skin, gorgeous brown eyes, and deep black hair cascading down in a mass of carefully groomed ringlets. 15 at the time of her disappearance, 16 now. Meet Angelique Lovely Badeau, Angel to her friends, Lily to her family. Angelique disappeared 11 months ago from Mattapan, Boston, walked out of her school on a Friday afternoon in November, and then, poof. No sightings, no leads, no breaks in the case for 11 whole months. Bostonians will tell you that Mattapan is that kind of neighborhood. Rough, poor, filled with hardworking souls, of course, and a rich cultural heritage thanks to having the country's largest Haitian population outside of Florida. But also a hotbed of gang activity and violent crime. If you want to get shot or stabbed, Murderpan, as the locals call it, is the neighborhood for it. Which is where I now plan to rent a place, find a job, and question the neighbors. And I hope, through sheer guts, determination, and blind luck, I will find a girl the rest of the world seems to have forgotten already. I'm not a police officer. I'm not a private investigator. I have no special skills or training. I'm only me. An average, middle-aged white woman with more regrets than belongings, more sad stories than happy ones. My name is Frankie Elkin, and finding missing people, particularly minorities, is what I do. When the police have given up, when the public no longer remembers, when the media has never bothered to care, I start looking. For no money, no recognition, and most of the time, no help. Why do I do what I do? So many of our children have vanished. Too many will never be found, often based solely on the color of their skin. Maybe the question shouldn't be, why am I doing this, but why isn't everyone looking? Angelique Lovely Badeau deserves to come home. I consult my map one last time. I need to find the commuter rail to Morton Street. The map of Boston's T system shows it as a purple line, which of course matches nothing that I can see. I spin around here, I spin around there, then realize I shouldn't have left South Station. Back I head. I don't mind being lost, or confused, or even scared. All these years later, I'm used to it. Paul warned me I would push away everyone I loved, that I would end up putting myself in harm's way, that I didn't do this to save others, but to punish myself. Paul was always a very smart man. I spot the giant map for the MBTA system, follow the purple line with my finger, and spot my target. Once more on track, I head to Murder Pan. Chapter 2. It's 4 p.m. by the time I reach my first location. Stoney's, the sign announces out front. The red backdrop of the two-story building is peeling, with the white lettering more of a suggestion than a statement. In other words, it matches its squat, derelict neighbors jammed shoulder to shoulder down both sides of the block. The sidewalk is broader than I expected, and nearly empty this time of day. After some of the articles I've read, I would have expected to see gangs and dealers loitering in every doorway. In fact, I see random people bustling about with their everyday concerns, most of whom eye me, the lone white woman, with curiosity. I'm grateful to get off the street, pushing open the door and wheeling my bag into the dimly lit interior. For most of my adult life, I've worked as a bartender. Easy job for a transplant to get, and for the past 10 years, a good way to pick up local intel. Plus, I like the work. Bars are inevitably filled with the lonely and the loners. Feels like home. Now I register the stale scent of cigarette smoke sunk deep into the pores of the old building. Before me is a cluster of round wooden tables with mismatched chairs. Four booths line the wall to my right, the red vinyl cushions cracked but still putting up a fight. Three more booths to the left in much the same condition. I make out half a dozen customers, all black men, sitting randomly around the small space where their attention has been focused on the drinks in front of them. Now, each one raises his head long enough to regard me. If the locals on the street regarded me with curiosity, here, I get blatant suspicion. In this neighborhood, I'm the minority. Then again, same with the past year, and the year before that, and the year before that. I'm used to the looks, though that doesn't mean it's always easy to take. At least midday drunks have more serious matters to tend to. One by one, they return to their individual miseries, which leaves me with the dark wood bar, straight ahead, where a lone black man stands, drawing a tray of beer glasses one by one. I head for him. A trim figure, he sports gray hair and a groomed salt and pepper beard. His dark eyes are lined heavily, and he has about him the air of a man who's seen it all and lived to tell the tale. Stoney, I guess. You lost? He sets down one tall glass, picks up another. He wears a white apron tied around his waist and wields the dish towel with practiced dexterity. Definitely the owner, and a long-term tavern operator at that. I'm here about the bartending position. No. He grabs the next glass. I park my suitcase next to the bar, take a seat on a stool. His answer doesn't surprise me. Most of my conversations start this way. 20 years of experience, I tell him. Plus, I have no problem cleaning, brewing coffee, or working a fryolator. Fried food is the natural partner to booze, and this close to the kitchen, the air is thick with grease. Fried chicken, fried potatoes, maybe even fried plantains given the Haitian community. No, he says again. I nod. There's a second towel. I pick it up, select the wet glass nearest to me, and start drying. Stoney scowls at me, but doesn't stop me. No business owner argues with free labor. We both dry in silence. I like the work. The rhythmic feel of twisting a glass, buffing it with the towel. Even dry, the top lip of the glasses bears a faint white line. Years of beer foam, human lips. They're clean, though, which makes me partial to Stoney and his establishment. Plus, he has a room above the bar to let, at a price I can almost afford. I found it posted on a community board. I don't drink, I offer. The first tray of glasses is done. Stoney removes it from the bar, lifts a second tray of wet half glasses.
Teetotaler?
Stoney asks. No.
Here to save us?
You're assuming I've been saved. He grunts at that. We both resume drying. From what I've dug up, a significant portion of Mattapan's population, being from the Caribbean, speaks French, French Creole, Patois, etc. But I hear none of that in Stoney's voice. He has the clipped tones of most New Englanders. Maybe he's lived in Boston his entire life, or moved here from New York or Philadelphia to open his own place. It's always dangerous to make assumptions, and yet nearly impossible not to. Friend of Bill's, I volunteer after we finish the whiskey glasses and that tray is replaced with dozens of shot glasses. We both get back to work. Quick, brisk, thoughtless. The perfect meditative exercise. Stoney doesn't answer. He drives faster than me, but not by much. Water glasses? I ask when the shot glasses are done. He raises a brow. So, not an establishment big on non-alcoholic beverages. Good to know. You have a room to rent, I continue, folding my arms on the heavily lacquered bar.
Go home.
Don't have one. So this is what I'm thinking. I work for you 4 nights a week, 3 p.m. to closing, in return for free board. Stoney is a man who can communicate volumes with a single eyebrow. You're worried that I'm white, I fill in for him, or that I'm female, or both. You think I can't handle myself.
I'm a local business, frequented by locals. You're not local.
I make a show of twisting around on the bar stool. Funny, because I don't see too many locals lined up for the open position. And you've been advertising for 2 weeks. Room's been vacant even longer than that, which must mean something given how desperate everyone around here is for housing. I regard him curiously. Did someone die up there or something? He shakes his head. With no more glasses to dry, he crosses his arms over his chest and looks me straight on. He still doesn't say a word. I work hard. I tick off a finger. I'm on time, especially because I'm going to be living upstairs, and I won't siphon your booze. I pour fast, I know how to change out a keg, and I'm an excellent listener. Everyone likes a good listener.
They won't like you.
Neither did you, but you're coming around. Give me a month. By then, no one will notice my white skin or superior gender. I'll just be another fixture behind the bar. He raises another eyebrow, but doesn't say no. Finally,
why are you here? Plenty of other neighborhoods in Boston.
I have something to do here. He stares at me again. I hold his gaze. I like Stoney, a survivor. He's my kind of person, and sooner or later, he'll come to see the same about me.
5 nights a week, he says, 3 p.m. to close.
Rent includes utilities, I counter. 1 free meal a day, I keep my tips. He regards me a moment longer, then abruptly extends his hand. We shake. Definitely my kind of person.
Room comes with a roommate,
Stoney informs me. That wasn't in the ad.
Now you know.
Male or female?
Feline. The room comes with a cat, and that's why no one will take it? For the first time, Stoney smiles. It wrinkles his salt and pepper beard, softens his weathered face.
You haven't met the cat yet.
Stoney leads me upstairs. At first glance, the tiny single-room setup is exactly what I'd expect from an apartment in an overcrowded, economically depressed neighborhood. Double bed shoved against the far wall, lone nightstand to one side, tightly drawn black curtains on the other. A metal rod bolted to the wall serves as a closet opposite the bed, while next to the front door is a small kitchenette with a European-sized fridge and a microwave. No oven, but a coffee maker and a hot pot, which suits me fine. On the other side of the door is a plain white curtain wrapped around a curved rod attached to the ceiling, much like a hospital room setup. A quick look behind the curtain reveals a bathroom with the world's skinniest standing shower and a minuscule mounted sink. Again, City Living 101. Not much space or privacy, but priced right. Not to mention, the room is unerringly clean, while the bed is topped with a surprising colorful handmade quilt. Again, there's more to Stoney than meets the eye. I glance around. Where's my roommate?
She's not social.
Does she have a name?
Piper.
And this is her room? He shrugs.
Suits her.
I'm still not sure what to make of this. In theory, I like cats, but Stoney's words of warning have made me cautious. I wheel my bag to the center of the creaking old floor, then pause. I bend over, carefully lift the quilt and peer under the bed. It takes me a moment. Then I spy a pair of glowing green eyes regarding me balefully from the far corner. It's too dark to make out her build or coloring. I have more an impression of pure hostility. Piper, I acknowledge. She flattens her ears and growls low in her throat, followed by a distinct hiss. I take the hint. Drop the quilt. Okay, then. Stoney is already turning back to the hallway. Hang on. Cat food, water, litter box? What do I need to know?
Nothing. Piper takes care of herself. She's not stupid, just hates people.
How long has she lived here? Stoney scratches his beard.
Long enough.
You took her in off the street?
She came in off the street.
Stoney gestures to the open door, which I now realize has a small pet-sized hole cut out.
Piper heads downstairs at night, patrols for mice. She's got food, water, and litter box in the basement. Nothing for you to worry about.
We didn't talk start day. I don't know why, but I suddenly feel a bit panicky. Not about being alone with a cat. So, then, about being alone? Except I'm alone all the time. It's my way of life. No reason to balk at it now.
Tomorrow, he says. Oh, door lock isn't so great. Got a computer in that bag. I'd hide it before you leave each day.
I nod.
Hot water comes and goes. Mostly goes.
Okay.
No smoking.
I don't.
No guns.
I don't.
And in the event of trouble?
I rely on my charming personality. He grunts.
I keep a baseball bat behind the bar. In the event your wit fails.
Good to know. Final nod. Then he's clearly ready to get back to his customers down below, leaving me and the feral cat. He surprises me by turning back at the last minute.
Come on down when you're ready and help yourself to some food. I don't have time to wait on a non-paying customer, but you can make yourself a sandwich. I keep all the fixings on hand.
It's the most words he's spoken to me. I wonder if Piper received the same offer when she showed up. Maybe Stoney has a thing for strays. Or maybe, like most bartenders, he recognizes a lost soul when he sees one. I nod my thanks. He leaves. I remain standing in the middle of my new home. For weeks? Months? I have no idea. Beginning is the hardest part,
and though I've done this before, I can't help but feel overwhelmed. Which makes the dark beast of my addiction stir in my belly, opening a single eye to survey the opportunity. While I'm downstairs making a sandwich, I could pour a beer. Or even better, vodka, tequila, whiskey straight up. Something potent and searing that would turn my muscles into liquid and chase all my fears away. I think of Paul. I feel the familiar pain squeezing my chest. Deep breath in, deep breath out. Then I leave my suitcase to the mercy of a feral cat and, as long as it's still light out, head back to the street, where I consult my printed map again and the red X that marks Angelique's aunt's house. I resume walking, aware once more of all the eyes falling upon me and the deepening chill whispering up my neck. I keep my head up, my shoulders back. I smile in greeting. I tell myself I'm strong enough, and I pray this time that I really am. Chapter 3. All I know about this area is what I looked up prior to arrival. Mattapan is densely populated, more than 35,000 people crammed into apartments, city housing, and so-called triple-deckers. The majority of the people are immigrants, which adds splashes of ethnic food and specialty hair salons. There are small pockets of Latin and Asian Americans, as well as an even smaller cluster of Caucasians. Google Earth revealed some shocks of green space amid the massive overcrowded streets. Harambe Park, the Franklin Park Zoo, and the Boston Nature Center. Not being accustomed to city life, I'd probably be more comfortable in those areas, but I can barely afford a single room with a hostile cat over a bar. An apartment with a view is out of the question. My primary concern is the area's crime stats. Half a dozen stabbings a week, not to mention the monthly shootings and annual homicide rate. Gang activity mostly, but predators are predators, and as a middle-aged woman, I'm not particularly intimidating. The best I can do, as I start navigating the confusing mishmash of city streets, is utilize basic personal safety rules. 1. I don't carry anything of value. No smartphone, no electronics, no purse. I have the world's stupidest track phone, which is one of the reasons I'm old school when it comes to research and navigation. In lieu of a purse, I have my driver's license and a couple of bills jammed deep into my front pocket. Some kid wants to demand all my worldly goods? Have it. You can't take from someone things she gave up a long time ago. Tucked into my jacket pocket is a red rape whistle, because there are worse things than muggings. I also wear stainless steel tactical clips in my hair. Each boasts tiny saw teeth, a wrench, a ruler, and a minuscule screwdriver for the low, low price of $3.99. I have no idea if hair clips can really be that effective and hope I never have to find out. Finally, I have my necklace, a plain gold cross, picked up at a pawn shop years ago and now worn tucked under my shirt. Again, sometimes the simplest things remain the best deterrent. Another trick? Attach myself to others when possible. Predators prefer the lone game, so don't look too lonely. This time of evening, that strategy is easy to accomplish. 5 p.m., buses are screeching to a stop, disgorging piles of weary locals grateful to be heading home. The sun is still out but lower in the sky, a fall breeze starting to kick up, carrying with it the stench of diesel, grime, and human sweat. I catch the occasional whiff of fried food and savory spices. My stomach rumbles again. I've never eaten Haitian food. Judging by the smell, however, I'm looking forward to trying it. For now, I keep hoofing it. I don't really understand Boston's mass transit yet, and I have at least a mile to cover, from Stoney's place to the side street where Angelique's aunt lives. Everywhere I look are tired buildings and worn faces. Bit by bit, I start to parse it out. The groups of teens with thousand-yard stares peering out sullenly from beneath their hooded sweatshirts. The wide streets jammed with brake lights and blaring horns. Intermittent booms of music, from reggae to rap, blasting out of various vehicles. A crowd of older black men, probably returning from a local construction project given the dust on their clothes, laugh and clap one another on the back, grateful for the end of the workday. Ahead of me, another city bus screeches to a halt. This time, a group of black women in pink hospital scrubs and bright-colored headscarves disembark. Local healthcare workers. I fall in step behind the last member of the line as they stream forward into the night. The woman directly in front of me notices the slowing of my gait as I slide in behind her. She nods once in acknowledgement of my presence. I'm no threat to her, and she clearly recognizes my strategy. Safety in numbers. I think of this often, drifting from community to community, always being the stranger and never the neighbor. People all over really are the same. They want to fall in love. They're glad to survive each day. They pray their children will have a better life than they did. These truths bind us. At least, I like to think so. The sun sinks lower, but the street grows brighter. More car lights, shop lights, street lamps. My lead companion peels off to the right with a parting nod. I return the gesture, plodding forward on my own. At the end of the next block, I have to pull out my printed map. I hate doing that in the open, as it marks me as lost, and even now, I can feel gazes boring into my back. I wasn't lying to Stoney when I told him all I had to rely on was my quick wit, which, interestingly enough, can be very useful when dealing with people above the age of 25, but completely irrelevant to anyone younger. I didn't grow up in the city, nor as a young girl did I ever picture myself doing this kind of work. I was raised in a small town in Northern California. My father was a drunk. As an adult looking back, I came to recognize his addiction as I learned to fight my own. But for most of my childhood, I associated my father with silly adventures and sloppy smiles, as well as the smell of beer. My mother was the intense one. Worked two jobs, the first as a secretary in a law firm, the second doing the books for mom-and-pop businesses. I don't remember her smiling or playing, or even stopping long enough to give me a hug. She got up early and worked late, and in her brief moments at home, mostly gritted her teeth at the dishes my father hadn't done, the meals that hadn't been cooked, the dirty clothes that hadn't been washed. I think my father loved my mother for her fierceness, and she loved him for his sense of fun, until they didn't. I ran around outside a lot, through woods and scrub brush and winding streams. In my childhood, we didn't have amber alerts or stranger danger. Even seven-year-olds felt free to dash out their front doors and ride their bikes for miles. I had friends who were latchkey by nine because why not? We didn't worry. We just were. I don't think any of us realized that was a magical moment future kids would never get to experience. Certainly, we didn't understand what bad things lurked out there. Until one of my classmates went missing in high school. Then another girl from the town over, and four more girls quickly after that. The police caught the killer when I was 25. By then, I'd moved down to LA, with no real plan other than to get the hell out of small-town life and party like a rock star. Turned out I was damn good at the partying part, and pretty enough for others to buy my drinks, my meals, maybe even a new dress or two. I'd like to say those were my free spirit days, but the truth is, I don't really remember them. It was a rush of drugs and booze and sex, and that I'm alive at all. Paul, he saved me, at least until I grew strong enough to save myself. House, white picket fence, suburban bliss. Funny. the things you can grow up not wanting, then suddenly crave with single-minded obsession. Funnier still, the things you can end up having only to realize you'd been right the first time. But I loved Paul. I still love him, even now. I arrive at my targeted block, which peels off the main road in a sharp diagonal. Definitely no grid system here. Instead, the streets come together, then explode in a crazy hub and spoke system. This is not going to be one of those places I learn to navigate quickly or easily. My best guess, weeks from now, I'll still feel exactly as dazed and confused as I do at this moment. Maybe Boston neighborhoods aren't meant to be understood. You either know where you are or you don't. I definitely don't. Now, the rows of squat brick commercial buildings are replaced by a wall of triple deckers, wedged shoulder to shoulder like a line of grumpy old men. I make out chain link fences, dirt patch yards, and sagging front steps that delineate each residence. Some have new vinyl siding in shades of pale blue and butter yellow. Others appear one strong breeze from total collapse. Mattapan has some of the last affordable housing in the city for a reason. Fifth home down the block, with bay windows and a sturdier-looking front porch. This is it. I double-check the house number to be sure, then note the light glowing from the second-floor apartment that is listed as belonging to Angelique Badeau's aunt. This is the moment it becomes real, where I go from being well-intentioned to being fully committed. I don't know what will happen next. A tentative welcome, a harsh refusal, a wailing torrent of desperate grief, or steely-eyed suspicion. I've experienced it all, and it never gets any less nerve-wracking. From here on out, my job is to listen, accept, adapt. And hope, really, truly hope, they don't hate me too much. Lainey Whitehorse's grandmother hugged me in the end, though the tribal council pointedly gave me their backs. I remind myself, I'm good at what I do. I swear to myself that I will make a difference. I think, uneasily, that like any addict, lying is what I do best. I head up the front steps. On the front porch, I encounter six buzzers, meaning the triple decker hasn't been carved up only by level, but within each floor as well. Beneath the buzzers is a line of black-painted mailboxes, each one locked tight. It's a simple but efficient system for the apartment dwellers. I try the front door, just in case, but am not surprised to find it bolted tight. Next, I press the first few ringers, prepared to announce myself as delivery and see if I can get lucky, but no one answers. Which leaves me with the direct approach. I hit 2B. After a moment, a male voice, younger, higher, answers. Yeah? I'm looking for Gerline Violette. She know you? I'm here regarding Angelique. Pause. Angelique has a younger brother, Emmanuel. Also a teen. I would guess this is him, particularly as his tone is already defensive with an edge of sullen. He sounds like someone who's been subjected to too many experts and well-wishers and been disappointed by all of them. You a reporter? He demands now. No. Cop? No. My aunt's busy. I'm here to help. We heard that before. I can practically feel the eye roll across the intercom. Definitely a teen. My time is free, and I'm experienced. What do you mean? If I can talk to Gerline, I'd be happy to explain in person. Another pause. Then a female voice takes over the intercom. Who are you, and why are you bothering us? Gerline's voice ripples with hints of sea and sand. Her niece and nephew immigrated to Boston as young children a decade ago, along with tens of thousands of other Haitians after Port-au-Prince was nearly flattened by an earthquake. Emmanuel has grown up in Boston and sounds like it, but his aunt has retained the music of her native island. My name is Frankie Elkin. I'm an expert in missing persons. I've been following your niece's disappearance, and I believe I can help.
You are a reporter, yes?
No, ma'am. I don't work for any news agency or reporting outlets. My only interest is finding Angelique and bringing her home.
Why?
The question is not defensive, but quiet. It tears at me, the amount of weariness in that single word.
I wish I had an answer for her. Something simple like because, or poignant, such as every child deserves to be found,
or defiant like why not?
But the truth is, she's probably heard it all by now.
A whole torrent of words and reasons. Instead of being given the one thing she wants most, answers.
The silence grows.
I should attempt some line of argument, but nothing persuasive comes to mind.
Then, a noise from inside the building. Stairs creaking as a lightweight rapidly descends. Another occupant, or the click of the bolt lock snapping back. The front door cracks open, and I find myself face to face with a Haitian teenager.
Tall, gangly, close-cropped dark hair and deep brown eyes, a perfect match with his sister's. He takes a second to look me over through the slit of the open door, features as wary now as his voice had been earlier. He turns, already dropping hold of the door. It's up to me to grab the edge, push through, and follow him up ancient wooden stairs to the second floor.
Gerline Violette stands in the middle of a cramped living room, her arms crossed over her formidable figure. I peg her age somewhere between 40 and 50, but her smooth, dark skin and classic features make it hard to determine. She's clad in purple scrubs, seamed with orange trim, and has bright green Crocs on her feet. She's a daunting woman, especially with her hair pulled into a thick bun on top of her head, calling attention to her high cheekbones and handsome brow. But upon closer inspection, I spy the purple smudges of long nights and fearful days that bruise her eyes. She watches my approach with a mix of suspicion and dread. I can't say that I blame her. Emmanuel closes the door behind me, then comes over to stand awkwardly by his aunt. At 13, he's already my height, with the slender build of a kid who's recently undergone a growth spurt. In contrast to his aunt's colorful ensemble, Emmanuel is wearing the official uniform of teen males everywhere. Sneaks, jeans, and a worn t-shirt. He looks young, clean-cut, and determined. The man in the family, even if it scares him. These are the kind of cases that break my heart. Belatedly, I stick out my hand. Gerline clasps it briefly, more out of politeness than welcome. The one-bedroom apartment houses three people and looks it. Gerline gestures to the cramped family room that clearly serves as a common room, bedroom, and dining room all rolled into one. What the room lacks in space, it makes up for in color. Yellow walls, an overstuffed red velvet chair, a sofa piled with bright patterned sleeping quilts, all bleeding into turquoise kitchen cabinets to the right. I go with a red chair, positioned in front of the window. On the wall beside me is a high wooden shelf bearing photos of gold-framed saints, some religious icons, and a single dangling rosary. Below it, running along first the tall bureau, then the long cabinet holding the TV, is a riot of green houseplants, adding to the room's ambiance. Between a pocket of green leaves, I spy a discreet cluster of white candles, arranged in a semicircle with a bowl of water and fresh-cut flowers before them. Angelique's framed photo, the same shyly smiling picture used in the missing persons flyers, is positioned next to candles. Gerline catches me eyeing the makeshift altar, and I quickly look away. According to what I've read, many Haitians practice a mix of Catholicism and voodoo, but it's not something I know much about. I turn my attention to the other knickknacks littering the room. A clear baby food jar filled with sand, a touch of Gerline's island home.
Then I spot the requisite school photo of Emmanuel, his teeth a flash of white. Next to it, a smaller picture of an adult female, the colors faded, the background hard to make out. The woman's smile is familiar, however. If I had to guess, Emmanuel and Angelique's mother, who still lives in Haiti. Finally, I spot a photo of a graying couple, framed by palm trees. Gerline and her sister's parents may be taken outside their home before the earthquake destroyed it.
You say you can help, yes? Gerline states, moving to the sofa, her hand resting on the pile of quilts.
Emmanuel follows closely behind. He is obviously protective of his aunt. I wonder if he was protective of his older sister, too, or if it was her disappearance that made him realize the need to guard his loved ones. My name is Frankie Elkin, I repeat for both of them. I travel all around the country, handling cases just like your niece's.
Gerline frowns, trying to absorb what I said. You are a private investigator? She asks, at last in her French lilted English.
I am not a licensed PI. I'm a volunteer. I'm never sure how to explain this part. There are actually quite a few people like me, laypersons, who are dedicated to assisting in missing persons investigations, from search dog handlers to pilots to boots on the ground. There are organizations, missing persons boards, where we follow cases like your niece's.
Gerline is frowning. My Angelique. She is on some message board?
On the internet, Matin, Emmanuel murmurs at her shoulder. She's talking about reading details on the internet.
I nod.
According to reports, Angelique left school Friday, November 5th, at 3:15 p.m. No one has seen her since.
The police looked and looked.
Gerline assures me, her fingers twisting absently.
Ricardo, our community officer, he promised me they would bring my angel home, but now it has been many months since there has been any news.
They found her backpack.
Yes, under a bush on school grounds.
The backpack contained her cell phone, her school books, and the outfit she'd worn to school that day?
Gerline nods.
I glance at Emmanuel, wondering if he knew his sister had packed a change of clothes, that she must have been planning something that Friday afternoon. But his face remains perfectly expressionless. No sign of violence, I prod, because not all details are made public.
Gerline shakes her head. Nothing. They found nothing, even on her phone. Ricardo tells me they can read the texts, see the phone calls, but there is nothing saying where she was going, what she might be doing. Her friends, they swear they don't know anything. Lily went to school. Then she was to come home, start dinner. Except.
Gerline looks as lost now as she must have felt 11 months ago. Her hands tremble. She clasps them tight, a model of grace, even in her grief. Did Angelique have close friends? I push.
Kira and Marjorie. Good girls, too.
But I catch an edge of hesitancy in the last statement, which intrigues me. Boyfriends?
Lily keeps to herself. No boys, parties, those sorts of worries. She is a very good girl, a caring sister, a loving niece.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Violette. Had she been having issues with anyone lately? Another classmate, teacher, coach?
Gerline shakes her head.
Emmanuel fixes his gaze on the floor with studied avoidance. More questions for me to ask later. Girl drama? I try one last time. You know how it can be with teenagers. Bestie today, arch enemy tomorrow.
Not my Angelique. She has a good head on her shoulders, that one. She wants college, a future. You understand.
Gerline gazes at me directly, and I get it. Angelique didn't want to return to Haiti. She wanted to get into college and hopefully be granted a student visa so she could remain in this country with all its opportunities.
I am a CNA, Gerline tells me softly. Nursing is a good job, but Angel, one day, she will be a doctor, maybe a surgeon. She is that smart.
This is why my sister sent her children to me, though it hurts her heart for her babies to grow up so far away. They must have hope. Our beautiful Haiti. The earthquake took away too much, and rebuilding is slow. Emmanuel clasps his aunt's shoulder. Do the police have any leads? Maybe a person of interest? I press. Gerline shakes her head. Theories? Angelique left willing? Unwilling?
She would never go willingly,
Gerline informs me flatly. She crosses her arms over her broad, purple-clad chest and takes on the slightly defiant look I already recognize from her nephew. I don't push it. There's no point in arguing with a family's beliefs or perspectives. They have to get through each day, which makes truth a fickle companion. How can you help? Emmanuel speaks up abruptly, his chin's up, also challenging me. What can you do that the police didn't? I'm sure the police did a fine job, I supply soothingly, though I'm not sure about that at all. Bear in mind, however, that even the best detectives have dozens of cases that demand their attention, especially now, after so much time has passed. Whereas for someone like me, your sister is my sole focus. I'm here to find her, and I won't leave until I do. You're living here? In this neighborhood? I took a room above Stoney's. The boy can't hide the look of surprise across his face, followed almost immediately by a scowl. You're crazy. Gerline gives her nephew's shoulder a light smack. Don't insult our guest. Come on. Look at her, Maton. She's not police. She's not local. She's not... One of us, I mentally fill in for him. No one is going to talk to her, Emmanuel continues relentlessly. She will piss people off. How does that bring my sister back? His voice raises stridently at the end, his anger a testimony to his grief. I can tell his aunt understands, just as she can tell I understand. Briefly, we are bonded. Two older, wiser women sorry for the pain the world is causing our children. I'm happy you say you're satisfied with the police efforts, I offer. The truth remains, it's been nearly a year. The police have no new leads, or you would have heard about them. So even if you don't like me, or don't understand me, what do you have to lose? I stare Emmanuel in the eye as he seems the most hostile. You want your sister back. I want to help. Why not use me? Emmanuel doesn't have an answer for this. Judging from his expression, however, he still isn't convinced. His aunt, though, is slowly nodding. I wouldn't say she believes in me either, but she's clearly a practical woman, forged by a childhood of deprivation and an adulthood of uncertainty. She appears moved by my logic. Deep sorrow brackets her eyes. 11 months later, she's getting desperate. She doesn't share it with Emmanuel. They are both staying strong for each other. Now I'm here, upsetting their fragile ecosystem by offering hope. Emmanuel isn't ready, but Aunt Gerline knows better than to let it go. Securing permission is not always this easy. I've been thrown out of homes, had beer bottles tossed at my head, vicious threats spewed in my face. For some, rage is easier to handle, and many families do have secrets to hide. I don't think Gerline is one of those people. Emmanuel? He knows more than he's saying, I'd bet. But I'd also bet he thinks he's protecting his sister with his silence, meaning my real job will be convincing him otherwise. I rise. I don't want to overwhelm Gerline or alienate Emmanuel, not when I can tell both truly want answers. I focus on Gerline. Ricardo, the community officer. Can you give me his information and let him know I'll be in touch? Or I can give you mine to pass along to him if you prefer? Gerline nods, and I scribble down the number to my track phone. If you could call Angelique's school, give permission for the principal or a school counselor to speak with me? Another faint nod. I'm living above Stoney's, I repeat now, seeing the exhaustion starting to take over. I also work there several nights a week. If you need to reach me in person, please feel free to find me there. I am not just here for Angelique, but also for you. Emmanuel mutters something sardonic under his breath, but Gerline grasps my hand firmly this time. I am unexpected and unfamiliar to her, but she is a woman with nothing to lose. This is how most cases start, with a bubble of desperate hope and tentative trust. Where things go from here, how Gerline and Emmanuel might view me months from now. Emmanuel walks me back downstairs. He doesn't speak a word, relying on the rigid set of his shoulders to radiate disapproval. You love Angelique, I state softly when we reach the lobby. She's a good older sister. She looks out for you. He glares at me, but I see a bright sheen in his eyes, the pain he's trying hard not to show. You really done this before? He asks roughly. Many times. How many people have you actually found? 14. He purses his lips, clearly taken aback by that number. Good night, Emmanuel. And if you think of anything I should know, I stick out my hand. This time, he takes it. Then I exit the triple, out into the crisp fall night where the sun has set. Bright lights wink in the distance, but on this block, no streetlights are working. Not the best idea for a lone woman to be walking around after dark, but I hardly have a choice. I square my shoulders and head briskly back towards Stoney's, grateful it hadn't occurred to Emmanuel to ask the next logical question. Not just how many people I'd found, but how many people I'd brought home alive. None. At least, not yet. Chapter 4. Leaving Gerline's apartment, I can just make out shadowy clusters of people on front stoops as I pass. I walk with my hands tucked in the front pockets of my olive green jacket. It would be warmer if I buttoned it up, but I don't want to risk any restrictions to my movements, especially as the first shape peels off from a front porch, exits the chain-link fence, and falls in step behind me. I don't pause or turn around. I head straight to the end of the block, where the red crossing light forces me to draw up short. Footsteps behind me. Closer. Closer. I move to the side, clearing an opening beside me. The second person stops in the empty space. Black male, anywhere between 18 and 25. Tall, broad-shouldered, with an oversized Patriots hoodie that makes him appear even taller and broader. He glances at me. I keep my gaze straight ahead. The crossing light turns green. He steps off the curb, one of his strides easily twice the length of my own. I'm just starting to relax, walking now in his wake, when I realize I can still hear footsteps behind me. A second set, which I'm immediately paranoid has been there all along. I make it across the intersection, only to realize the next block of triple-deckers is as dimly lit and ominous as the last. Turn around and confront the person? Pick a door and pretend it's my final destination? Options. I should pick one. Exercise some kind of caution as the footsteps quickly close the gap. I whirl at the last second, preparing to meet the possible threat head on. The black girl behind me draws up short. She's wearing skinny jeans, a tight-fitting ribbed cotton shirt, and huge silver hoops, along with a black leather jacket and matching stiletto-heeled boots. She lifts a finely etched eyebrow. You nuts, lady? This is not a place to be walking alone after dark. Yo, Jazz, hold up! Then she scoots around me, catching up with the broad-shouldered kid and looping her arm through his. They saunter down the block. I tell myself I'm okay. Mostly, I bolt quickly down the maze of streets to Stoney's bar. I'm a recovering addict. It's taken me a couple of tries, but I've now been sober for 9 years, 7 months, and 18 days. And yet I still love walking through the doors and inhaling the scent of a tried and true local pub. It feels like coming home. Many of my fellow AAs manage their recovery by avoiding booze and any situation involving alcohol. In the beginning, I did too. Well, kind of. I spent hours circling the outside of my local watering hole, wanting desperately to go in, willing myself to stay outside. That's how I met Paul. He recognized me, what I was going through. And for a while, he believed in me, when I wasn't ready yet to believe in myself. I did the 90 and 90 drill, got a sponsor, got a new sponsor, decided the program wasn't for me. Worried sobriety wasn't for me. Mostly, quietly, desperately understood that being me wasn't for me. I didn't know how to do it. I never had. After more than a dozen years of AA and two reboots, I know firsthand there's more than one path to sobriety. AA's simple truth, however, admitting helplessness over alcohol and finding strength through a higher power, remains the best starting point that I've experienced. I attend my meetings, I read from the big book, I find comfort in the company of people living honest, messy, difficult lives without